Hello and welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 123 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to experience aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions about any topics anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where we're also going to share an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. In early June, my friend and colleague Rabbi David Fine published an article in the Jerusalem Post entitled, "If We're So Smart, Why Are We So Divided?" In it, he noted that the Jewish people can win Nobel Prizes for economics or medicine, among many other achievements, but why is it that the holy grail of Jewish unity is so elusive? He suggested we apply the same efforts and imagine the goal to crack the code on Jewish unity, not just in theory, but through practical steps, a plan. That's what triggered this important conversation today, and the link to his important article will be provided in the notes. Today, we're having a different kind of conversation on Inspiration from Zion. Most of our audience is typically Christian, and we always seek to use these conversations to build bridges between Jews and Christians, to offer insight and topics from and relating to Israel in areas that can bring greater understanding. This conversation will do that for sure, but it's a uniquely Jewish topic. It brings non-Jewish friends into the position of figuratively being a fly on the wall of Jewish homes throughout Israel, addressing a complex and sometimes painful issue that we, the Jewish people, have been grappling with basically as long as there have been a Jewish people. It's going to bring you into the depth of our being as a people, and especially since the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. For some, it may be like airing dirty laundry, which I typically hesitate to do. Some may say that these are internal conversations, that non-Jews don't need to be or maybe shouldn't be involved. But if we're being honest and if we're building bridges and truly want our non-Jewish friends to understand us, this is one of the most critical conversations to have, especially now. As I was preparing for the conversation, I was brought to a pivotal prayer in the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur liturgy, Hineni. Christian friends will know the word as Hineni, Moses' response to God at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3, verse 4. But on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the word and the prayer are used differently by the Chazan, Christians will call that the prayer leader, who beseeches God that his personal failures and flaws should not limit God's hearing and answering the prayers of the congregation. In the English, according to Art Scroll, goes like this. Here I am, impoverished of deeds, trembling and frightening from the dread of him who is enthroned upon the praises of Israel. I have come to stand and supplicate before you, your people, Israel, who have sent me, although I am unworthy and unqualified to do so. Therefore, I plead to you, O God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob, compassionate and gracious God, God of Israel, frightening and awesome, grant us success to the way upon which I go, standing to plead for mercy upon myself and upon those who sent me. The prayer goes on, but I feel a little bit like that person now, feeling the responsibility, the weight of this conversation, because it's so big, and I don't want my limitations to have any negative impact on it. I know that we cannot and will not solve the issues that are creating disunity among the Jewish people, not in Israel and not in the world, and certainly not in an hour today. But I do pray that this will be a positive catalyst in that direction. And while I may be unworthy and unqualified to do so, I'm humbled and grateful that our panelists are not. I will try to measure up, and together today, I hope we can crack the code. Rabbi David Fine is the founder and dean of the Barkai Center for Practical Rabbinics and Community Development, training a new generation of rabbinic leaders in Israel. Rabbi Fine served as spiritual leader of congregations in Milwaukee and in Kansas, and is actively involved in initiatives assisting Anglos in Israel and increasing Aliyah. He's the host of the Defining Moments podcast and was a candidate for the 25th Knesset. J.J. Sussman is the international director of Gesher, an organization dedicated to bridging the gaps between different segments of Israeli society and fostering unity. Before joining Gesher, he worked in the high-tech sector for more than 15 years. He's also the host of the Impacting Israel podcast. We're going to dispense with titles today, not out of disrespect, but because today we're just three concerned Jews in Israel looking to shed light on a critical issue and solutions for our future. David and JJ, welcome to Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So let's jump in. This is important, and it is quite awesome to me, at least. David, I want to share the link to your article. It was shared in the invitation for this. But what was the motivating factor for that, especially when you wrote it?
The motivating factor was, I said in the article itself, that on Shavuot, the Pentecost or holiday, you know, 7 weeks following Passover, which is commemorates the giving of the Torah itself, and the verses there speak about unity, right? So on Shavuot or before Shavuot, rabbis and communal leaders are always talking about Jewish unity and the importance of Jewish unity. But I feel like it's very trite. It's very empty. It doesn't really have any meaning. It's just things that people say. And, you know, a year later, we're just as disunified as we were a year before. It seems to me, or perhaps even more disunified. So I use that as an opportunity to try and share the ideas that I did in the article.
Thank you. JJ, you do this for a living. What's your secret sauce? What's Gesher's secret sauce?
So if I gave away the secret sauce, I think my living would not be my living anymore. But seriously, you know, you started with quoting from the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur prayer, and I see one of the attendees was actually the Baal Tokea, the one who blew the shofar when I was a child many decades back growing up in New York. So just like your intro, I think hearing the sounds of the shofar is a wake-up call for all of us, I think, to think about how we do it. But if I would summarize in one word what Gesher, where I work, has been predicated upon for all these years, it's been working to try to foster Jewish unity. The word in Hebrew I would use is mifgash. And what mifgash means in English is that people need to meet one another. And once we step away from the keyboards, once we come into a room and meet the people on the other side, that's usually a harbinger for having the flames kind of reduced and being able to disagree while staying united. And I think there's an incredibly important distinction there between disagreement, which I think is a feature of the Jewish people, and disunity, which is something we can't afford to have disagreement lead to.
So let me flip it. I want to get into some specifics and be sure that we have time at the end to talk about substantial plans of action. Again, recognizing that we're here having a conversation for an hour. And I do want to invite all those who are joining us live to use the Q&A feature to share any thoughts you have, any questions, comments, and maybe you've got the solution, the silver bullet. But for right now, for David and JJ, what does Jewish unity mean to you? It's, I think, easier to identify the disunity. David, you mentioned maybe we're more disunified today than we were a year ago. 2 years ago, we were in a whole different set of disunity on completely different issues. What does it mean, unity, especially now and especially this week as we are approaching Tisha B'Av?
So first of all, I just want to make a note, because you said when you were talking about my article at the beginning, you said the Holy Grail. I did not use that term.
No. That was my.
I'm an Orthodox rabbi. Anyway, you said we only have an hour, and you told us before to try and be as concise as possible. I think what JJ just said is so important. It's so trite, but things become trite because they need to be repeated, and it always needs to be repeated. I'll say it a little differently than what JJ said. There is unity and there's uniformity, right? That's said all the time. Unity means that we could disagree. We could disagree strenuously and passionately, but we disagree respectfully and properly according to Jewish tradition. Uniformity means that we all think the same thing, and people very much, mistake a one for the other. When I wrote my article, I got a lot of comments on messages on WhatsApp saying, "Oh, we don't need unity," and what they really mean is we can't see a time where everyone will agree on everything, right? So I'm saying that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for a disagreement, but respectful disagreement. I always say that the sages, our sages in the Talmud, who lived thousands of years ago, were the smartest people who ever lived in the history of the universe. And the principles that they laid out are still relevant and meaningful for today. And they laid out in the Talmud how to disagree respectfully. And if we could look back to our sources and see how the rabbinic sages did that, I think that would really, lead us to more unity. I'll just say one last thing. This is a religious group, and I think that unity, this is not necessarily answering your question, but I think it's important that it be said. Unity is not only utilitarian, right? It's not so that we can, do things, achieve things. Unity is an aspect, you quoted the Hineni, like JJ said. I see that my father is online. My father, and as I was growing up, he was the Shliach Tzibor, the choir leader for Musaf. Many times in my childhood, I heard him sing Hineni many times. So as you said that, I started thinking, hearing him sing it. But anyway, God is unified, right? We say Hashem Echad, Ushmo Echad several times a day in our prayers, right? God is one and his name is one. And therefore, we are commanded as Jews to imitatio Dei, to imitate God, right? And therefore, if we are to imitate God and God is one, we don't really understand what God is one really means, right? But if we are to imitate God, then even if it wouldn't bring any utilitarian results, any positive results, just in and of itself, we're commanded. So we need to see it religiously. I don't know that we often do that.
Okay. Do you want to be able to give, JJ, I want to just ask David to dig down a level deeper. You mentioned rabbinic sources. You want to highlight one or two that that are particularly relevant to this conversation?
There are so many. We have Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, right? These and those are the words of the living God, about the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, who argued vociferously, meaning you can't get through a page of the Talmud without seeing some kind of debate between Abaye and Rava, Amoraic Talmudic sages and Tanaim, Mishnah sages, and all that. If you read some of the Talmud, right, you would actually come away from some of the pages thinking that these people hated each other, right? And yet they respected, they loved, they married each other, they, davened together, they prayed together. And so there are so many important sources, but that's probably one of the most famous.
You just used two words that I want to come back to later, respect and love, but on a modern level. So basically Hillel and Shammai didn't unfriend each other because they were having differences, did they?
That's exactly where I want to pipe in, because I'm talking with a rabbi on this webinar. And I'm going to jump about a few thousand years forward to social media, about unfriending and the like. You asked what's Gesher's secret sauce. About a year and a half ago, the trends are against us. The algorithms are against us. It's very hard to foster unity when you're talking to your own echo chamber and you're hearing your own thoughts from all the people who are similar to you. So at Gesher, we came up with what we call the 5 rules for constructive dialogue. And you can look it up online, 5 rules for constructive dialogue. Gesher's 5 rules for constructive dialogue. I think there are subtitles in English as well. But they're basically very, very similar to what David just quoted from rabbinic sources, right? One is to really listen and pay attention to the other side. One is to focus on the actual argument and not on the person voicing the argument or voicing their opinion. One is to totally stay away from cursing and violence, seemingly obvious, but if you spend some time on social media, on Facebook or anywhere else, you'll see that's not as obvious as maybe our generation thinks it is. The other is, do not generalize. Stop calling people Haridim, Yemanim, Smolanim, right-wingers, left-wingers. If you focus on the specific people and not generalize entire communities, that's also an excellent way to have constructive dialogue. And finally, is don't just point out what the other side is wrong about. Try to offer your own opinion and be proactive in offering your own opinion and not just shooting down the other side's opinion. But I think all of those, if you take them as a whole, are very similar to what David pointed out to our rabbis have been talking about for years and millennia. And I think if we can apply them still today and keep on reinforcing them still today, especially to our youth, I think that will go a long way to helping create unity. And you ask just one more thing, what is unity to us? To me, the one word of what unity is, in Hebrew, mishpacha, in Yiddish, mishpucha, and in English, family. I think we all recognize that we are part of one family, the Jewish family. You can have really hard disagreements with your brother, with your sister. But at the end of the day, you're going to sit around that same dinner table with the whole family still, or that same Seder table on Passover. And I think if we can recognize that, we can really disagree, but recognize that we are all part of the same family. We have that same shared heritage, and hopefully that same destiny we're all striving towards. I think that will go also a long way.
Yeah, so, I think that's... Go ahead, David. Yeah.
If I could just comment on two things that JJ, you just said. So you talk about social media. You know, Jonathan, you asked us to make a list last week of what we think the reasons are for disunity. So I listed six or seven things, but I think that social media would top anyone's
list. Wow.
And what JJ just said about the five rules for constructive, I didn't get the exact term, but
we're going to put those in the notes. I'm going to get them.
There is research on all of this. There is research on what causes polarization, political polarization, what causes disunity, and there is research into things that work, right? And so one of the things that I found that works in research, not myself, is that many people don't even realize that social media creates polarization and disunity. They just think they're typing away on Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is. So educating, especially youth, about the negative implications of social media has been shown to be effective because, again, people are just like, you know, they just don't even know about it. And I'd also just say something about what JJ said about listening. You know, I run, you said it in the introduction, I run a rabbinic training program. And the first thing and the last thing and the middle thing that we teach rabbis to do is how to listen. It's called active listening. Now you'll say, what does that mean, active listening? Listening is not active, right? You just sit there and you listen. What's active about it? But no, most people don't know how to listen. Research proves that most people, when they're hearing, are actually thinking about how to answer, how to retort. And so we think that listening is easy. Listening is actually a very, very, especially in today's world with all the distractions, a very, very rare skill. And it's not just to be a rabbi. It's to be a good person and a good friend and a good spouse and a good parent. We have to learn how to listen. I tell rabbis all the time that if all you do is listen and nothing else and the person knows that you're there listening, that's already cured a lot of the problem.
I want to pause in the conversation for just a moment to invite you to join us in one of the really incredible programs that we do as part of the Genesis 123 Foundation. This year, we have been going out all throughout the Judean Mountains to show love to soldiers who are stationed keeping us safe from the threat of terrorism. It doesn't matter if we're in a burning heat wave or temperatures below freezing before the wind chill, they are out there guarding strategic points that have a high risk of terrorism. And thanks to the support of many people like you, we are pleased to bring them homemade hot soup in the cold of winter and cold drinks and sweet watermelon in the heat of summer. Any donation is meaningful and helps us to bless the soldiers. You can join us and donate at genesis123.co/blessasoldier. That's genesis123.co/blessasoldier. And when you do, you also have the opportunity to send along your own personal words of thanks and blessings to the soldiers guarding the land and protecting the people. Please join us.
You know, that reminds me, we at Gesher, we have a leadership institute where we take leaders in Israeli society in cohorts of about 15 to 20 from different sectors of Israeli society. And we bring them to a Jewish community outside of Israel to expose them to what world Jewry is all about. And before we leave, literally the day before we get on the plane to leave Israel, we gather them and we kind of prepare them for the trip. And we spend about 80% of that final session telling them we're not going to be ambassadors. We're not going to prove our point. We're going to listen, strengthening that listening muscle. And you can imagine with Israelis, we're good at a lot of things. Some of the things we're less good at is listening. And we have mayors and journalists, people who are not used to sitting back and listening and learning by listening. And I think what David said is absolutely critical, is you have to be able to know how to listen.
Yeah, my friend who's following live will nod and smile. Anita Jacobs, the beginning of my career with what was then National UJA, a lot of talk about soliciting people is also active listening. And Anita was involved with that.
And I just say, sorry, Jonathan, that we're trying to talk about practical solutions, right? So, I mean, I didn't think about this before, but just in terms of the conversation now, meaning let's say all over Israel or all over the Jewish world, wherever it may be, we have, you know, 3-hour active listening sessions for whoever is willing to come to teach people how to listen.
Right.
It's an acquired skill, right? Maybe, just maybe that could do something.
That's great. And you know, it's funny, when I asked you last week to come up with your list of top 3, 5, 10, however many issues that are the issues that are causing division. And I sent it out around to a number of people, diverse parts of the country, getting their responses. Most gave actual triggers, things that are relevant in our society today. I would say about 80% of them had to do directly or indirectly with the war, hostages, the war itself, the government. There was one other topic. And then I realized, and a few people, including my friend Ellie Stone, who's not here right now, and decided it was important enough to spend an hour talking about this. So we've discussed that it's actually the issues are the symptoms, except for the fact, David, that you mentioned a factor that promulgates the disunity, the social media. Not listening, not active listening. These are things that are broader skills. But when I came away from the conversation with these people responding back and forth and having a little bit of dialogue, I realized, goodness, how interesting that the issues that are creating disunity today, 80% are the war. Does that mean, or war related, does that mean that if the war stopped, we wouldn't have disunity anymore?
I can answer that right away. We at Gesher have been taking an index of what the most pressing conflict facing Israeli society is for Israelis. We've been polling Israelis year after year for the last now about 6 years, I think. And you can imagine at Corona time, the most pressing conflict facing Israeli society was the Haredi general Israeli society conflict. If you recall at the time, Haredim, again, I'm generalizing for going against what I just said, but for by and large, they weren't listening to the mandates by the government, and there was a lot of anger and hatred towards the Haredim. Fast forward 2 years later, it was a judicial reform, and then it was the anger between the right and the left. The conflict was the most pressing conflict between the right and the left, so much so that on the Yom Kippur, just 2 weeks before October 7th, we had that crazy incident in Tel Aviv where Jews were running into Yom Kippur services and breaking them apart. And fast forward to now, where we're having the draft issue is at the top of the headlines today. And again, the Haredi issue, the ultra-Orthodox not serving in, you know, again, generalizing, the ultra-Orthodox not serving as a community in the IDF is becoming the most pressing conflict. So I agree with you 1,000%. Right now, that's the issue, but it's an issue that's deeply seated in Israeli society. And that
in the non-listening, in looking at people not as part of the mishpacha, as the family, in the actual DNA of
yeah,
what.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, in Israeli society, if you're familiar with our educational system, for example, we have a siloed educational system. The Haredim have the ultra-Orthodox have their own educational system. The religious have their own. The secular have their own. And then the Arab population, which we'll ignore for purposes of this conversation, have their own as well. When you have a siloed educational system, if you don't do anything active about it.
Wow.
Then you're never going to meet somebody from the other sectors until you get to the army. And again, the ultra-Orthodox, by and large, aren't there. So you have stereotypes building up and walls building up and fears building up. So much so we have one of our programs, Gesher, is called Israeli Dialogue, where we try to shatter this stereotype and bring an ultra-Orthodox person into a classroom of 11th and 12th graders who are non ultra-Orthodox, whether they're religious Zionists or secular. And it's a program that's running now for 5 years. And we had someone from Tel Aviv University evaluate if we're being successful. And what she measured was something called the meta-perceptions, which for you smart people probably know what that means. But it's basically what I think you think of me. So it's what the students in the classroom think the ultra-Orthodox thinks of them. And that's proven to be academically a leader for hatred and violence even. And if our hypothesis was that if we're able to increase the participants' meta-perceptions of what the ultra-Orthodox think about them, we can bring down the level of hatred and really just focus on the real issues and the real disagreements. And we were successful in doing that with a very minor intervention. And again, it's by creating that meeting, by creating that, all of a sudden, instead of a Haredi person, an ultra-Orthodox person, he's a person with views that I vehemently disagree with. But it's very, very hard to hate with such hatred somebody who's sitting in front of you in the classroom and who you get to know and shares his personal stories with you as well.
I would just take great exception to what you said, Jonathan, at the beginning in terms of the war and the other issues that you stated, meaning we're not disunified because of the war. There, meaning the disunity comes first, right? And there's not a war because we're disunified, but there was a judicial reform crisis because we're disunified. I think the order is different. If there wasn't this issue, there would be that issue. And, right. 50 years and 100 years and 2,000 years ago, there were other issues. It's not the issues. It's the personality, I think.
Right.
Just talk about a minor intervention. Here's another minor intervention that I found in some of the research, right? It's called human connection videos, right? Human connection videos, you could Google it, right? It shows people with opposing views forming bonds with each other, right? Just those people seeing those videos brought down, disunity and political contempt, whatever you want to call it, by a significant amount. So these interventions that help, small amounts of people pretty soon, you help 10 people here, 100 people there. Gesher does this. Barkai does that. Other organizations do what they can do. And pretty soon, it grows. So I think we have to start small, but aim big.
And using your example earlier in terms of social media could also be harnessed if there were to be an initiative here in Israel where we make 10,000 30-second videos like what you're saying, and just blast them out all over social media and television spots, you can also reframe how people are thinking. And I agree with what you're saying, David. I approached this from a really wrong perspective. I figured, okay, we could list the top 5 issues and whatever those issues are, and they're different issues today than they were 2 years ago before the war, and as JJ mentioned, during COVID and however far back we want to go, we're going to have those issues. But it's the symptom of the disunity. It's the, and maybe this is a good way to pivot back. I think it was something you said, David, you were talking about. Yeah, you did. In terms of love and respect, this season before Tisha B'Av, we're talking about baseless hatred, Sina Chinam, as why the temples were destroyed, right? Okay, we accept that. And the opposite of that is typically Ahava Chinam, unconditional love. And I was speaking about this with somebody the other day, and I was wondering, is it love? Do you love somebody? Or do you have to respect somebody? And in fact, an anonymous person commented, JJ, in the Q&A about your normal family. And this person wrote, my life has been much better since I cut off contact with my brother. Okay, those are realities. Those are not things that we, if we're looking at a family. But my question is, do we still love the brother who we don't have contact with, or must we respect that brother for whatever reason that we're challenged? How do you play balance between love and respect? It's a phrase that you had brought up, David, or terms you had brought up.
I was more talking about the emotion that we're familiar with, but as long as you're asking me about love, I have a very long sermon that I give about love, but I won't spend the next 30 minutes.
You threw me on the panel with the rabbi.
Love in Jewish sources is not an emotion. It's an action, right? The Sefer HaChinuch, a very famous medieval book that talks about, describes all the 613 commandments, says, Akarei ha-pulot nimshachim ha-levavot, right? That our emotions follow our actions, right? So usually we think in modern times the opposite. First, I have to love somebody and then I'll do something for them, right? But I cannot be commanded to love J.J. Sussman, even though I do, right? I either like him or I don't, right? But if I do things for him, the actions will lead to emotional love. So I think that that's a very important, like I said before, that our Talmudic ideas could really be very relevant in our day, right? I don't necessarily have to love the person, you know, I want to hug them, I want to whatever, but I have to do for them. And if I do for them, then my emotion of love will increase and improve, right? We saw at the beginning of the war, you know, JJ mentioned the Haridim. So many Haridim, right, came out and did things for the soldiers, bought things for the soldiers, and it's quiet. It's not as loud as some people would like, but my belief is that I'm very optimistic. I think it'll take a very long time, but I'm optimistic from what I see on the ground about the developing, you know, the improved relations between Haridim, you know, ultra-Orthodox Jews, for lack of a better term, and others. So that's what I have to say about love. I think it's extremely important. I always use this in my rabbinic counseling. Somebody would come into my office and say, Rabbi, I don't think I could go to prayer services because I don't believe in God, right? So I said to them, go to prayer services and then you'll end up believing in God, right? It's the action that has to come first, not the emotion.
But is love going to create unity or upend those conditions that create disunity? Is love enough? I think there's a song in there.
If you define love as I just defined it, right, the more I do for others, the more I end up loving them, right? So I think that that's practically the only real way to develop even the emotion of love. But just regular love, you know, pass the candle, you know, sit at, put our arms together and sway to slow music. I'm just being silly to make a point. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Okay. JJ, love, respect. How do you feel that David loves you?
What's love got to do with this?
That's the one. I knew it was.
No, but honestly, look, if I want to put on my rabbinic hat, which I'm not a rabbi, I think it's the same word, love, that's used for loving God and for loving our fellow Jew. V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, love God, and v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, you know, love your neighbor like yourself. And I think love, it goes a long way towards creating unity. It's not easy. This whole conversation, unity, is not easy. I don't want to say Gesher has been trying to do this for decades, like I said, and I think it will continue needing to do this for decades. You know, humans have a natural way of slipping back into bad habits, and we need to constantly work on this. You know, somebody who I spoke with recently, and I asked him how, as somebody who's a facilitator at Gesher, and I asked him how he works on himself, how does he put himself in the shoes of the other, and he told me that every evening he watches in Israel both Channel 14, which is, I would say, the right-wing channel, and reads the Ydiot Ahronot or Ynet online to get a different perspective. And he does that to work on himself, to put himself in a position to understand what both sides are thinking. And I said, and what do you come out of it with? And he said, I recognize that both sides want what's good for Israel and for the Jewish people. And if we can recognize that in the other side, whatever side we're on, I think, again, that's the premise from which we start our disagreements, then it goes really a long way. It's another practical, you know, tidbit that you can start employing if you have time. You know, we're giving social media a bad rap here. He says he watches television, right? It's mainstream media, too. It's the equivalent of Fox and CNN in America. Very diametrically opposed viewpoints. But again, both trying to do what's best in their eyes for the good of the country. And I think that's another, everyone can apply it how they want, but it's another great tool for trying to create that sense of understanding between different sides.
For the record, when I travel, I watch Fox and CNN and sometimes MSNBC on purpose because I want to know what everyone's saying.
But do you do it in Israel, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, okay, that's another story. You're right. But I don't, by the way, even though my inclination is
right of center, I don't watch Channel 14. That's not where I'm getting my source.
It's hard to practice that listening muscle when listening to Israeli television also.
Yeah, more the mute button. So let me ask you a question. I'm glad that there's that Zoom is taking notes, because there's a lot to unpack from this, and we'll try and do so in a way, and maybe the three of us can publish something afterward. Certainly we'll share the link. There's a lot of ideas are already coming up, and again, I welcome anyone who wants to share some constructive ideas. But as I was preparing for this, and because it's so big, and because I'm the kind of person who's looking for the solution yesterday on everything. Everything's got... So it's frustrating to me, JJ, when you said, I know Gesher from years before I made Aliyah. And it's amazing. But to me, I'm frustrated that we haven't found that silver bullet yet. We haven't figured it out. But what I'm taking away and getting comforted, if you will, by both of you, is it's a process. And it's a process that requires a lot of nurturing. But what I was trying to wonder, and you're both in this much more than I, do we have a model for unity? Have we ever had unity? Is there something that we can emulate and say, remember when the Jewish people were unified back then? And David, I go back to the beginning when I asked you what was the catalyst for your article. You mentioned Shavuot. Okay, we all stood at Mount Sinai and received the Torah, and we were standing together and all said, yes, we na'aseh v'nishma, we'll do it and we'll hear it. So presumably there was unity, at least at that moment. But do we have a model that we can kind of dust off and say, well, let's just go back and stop trying to reinvent the wheel?
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit israelthemiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
So I said in my article that I believed that the giving of the Torah and the acceptance of the Torah by the Jewish people was really the only moment of unadulterated Jewish unity in the history of time. And I also said that if we were able to do that again, that it would bring the final redemption. So that's number one. Number two, the model I spoke about before. I think that the Talmudic model of the rabbis, of the sages, where people knew how to do both. You don't have to exclude one. You could debate vociferously, but also, like I said before, respect and love. Those two things are not mutually exclusive, and unfortunately, they're made out to be mutually exclusive in today's day and age.
Look, I think...
Go ahead, Junior.
No, I think a question I get a lot, and it comes up at specific times, I guess. You know, if you would have polled Israeli society, as David mentioned earlier, the week or two or three or four after the war broke out, you would have said there's tremendous Jewish unity. And the question is, how come we can always come together during times of tragedy and become unified, if the case, you know, during times of tragedy? And why can't we carry that forward to, quote unquote, everyday life? I'm sure growing up, we had the struggle for Soviet Jewry. I would say it was a mission that unified many parts of the Jewish community around the world. And we can all think after Entebbe, maybe you could have said it was another time where there was tremendous pride and even unity. And I think we can all think back to those times. What was it that made us feel unified? Was it a shared mission? Was it a sense of feeling attacked. You know, you have anti-Semitism going, you know, rampant all over the world today. Is that something that's going to unify us? Is that a good thing that that's what's unifying us or not? I'm not, you know, nobody really knows the answer to that. But I think instead of trying to focus on the general, what can we all do to create Jewish unity? Everyone should really try to focus on themselves. What can I do? What can I, J.J. Sussman, do to make myself better, to make myself understand the other side better? And again, it doesn't mean changing my opinion. It doesn't mean agreeing with the other side. But it does mean doing stuff, like David said earlier, doing stuff that shows the other side that I'm one with them. And I think if we all focus on ourselves, that gives us a much better shot to take that unity, which we do see during times of tragedy, and apply it to the everyday life.
Okay. David, I want to dig down a drop on something you just said, referring to unity. If we go back, if we could create that unity again, you said, if I noted it correctly, if we could do it, it would bring the final redemption. That's sort of the golden ring, right, that we're striving for, or the term that you seem to like, the Holy Grail.
I knew you were going to say that.
But I'm still, they're great little practical things. What JJ, you just said, in terms of what can I do myself? And actually, that's so relevant now. I know I'm all over the place because I'm thinking so many things. But again, in my conversation with Ellie Stone this week, I for the first time, I connected the dots that we're about to come into one of the few fast days on the course of the year. We're mourning. We all have these scruffy little beards going on, and right? Because we're in a period of mourning over the destruction of the temple because of baseless hatred. And this is a sense of national grief and identity. And in a month plus, we're going to be in less than a month, we're going to be in the month of Elul, where we're supposed to be taking that personal reflection, JJ, that you said, and then we're straight into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, where David's father is going to be saying that prayer that I alluded to at the outset, where we're all individually going to be beseeching God. But how do we merge those two is it good enough? And how are they, is it just coincidental that we have these? Certainly the Romans didn't decide to destroy the temple several weeks before we were going to be observing Rosh Hashanah there, but they are kind of connected, no?
Very much connected. I mean, we know why the date of Tisha B'Av falls out on the 9th of Av, right? The commentators on the Torah tell us in the story of the spies, which we read a few weeks ago, that the spies came back and reported to the people what was going on, and the people cried, right? And they were not appreciative. They weren't optimistic about what was about to happen. Instead, the sages say they cried b'tziyat chinam, like a useless and needless cry, right? And that's why, according to the sages, according to the commentators, Tisha B'Av happened when it did, right? So that's simply historical. But the idea behind that is extremely powerful, right? Meaning we have to be optimists. We have to be thankful. Thankful not only to God, but thankful to the people around us. And if we could sort of correct the sin of the spies, right, that will put us in a situation where a few weeks later, when Rosh Hashanah comes, we'll be able to stand before God. And the prayer leader won't need to say hineni, right? Obviously, I'm being a little extreme, but because we'll be in a point where we don't have to worry about our sins, perhaps, because we've created a situation where we're thankful to God and we're thankful to the people around us. And that, I think, is one of the elements of real unity.
So even more than Elul being our spring training for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we're already there. Right now, we have to
slow down. You're scaring a lot of people here who haven't started cooking for Rosh Hashanah yet. Slow down.
But not, I don't mean color.
We still have a summer.
I know. Okay, but
go ahead. Sorry, keep going.
No, we gotta bring that prism of a national responsibility, which, yeah, you're right. Okay, started with the spies, but take it to a We got to process it through that personal funnel so that, as you said, David, and it's a very beautiful aspiration, that we shouldn't need to be worried about that.
Yeah, but there's no question here.
Go on, JJ. Sorry.
I'll just be very brief, then I'll defer to you. But like you said before, you know, where the temple is destroyed because of baseless hatred, the second temple. But I think that's the only thing that's ever brought us down as a people has been our internal divisions and our internal hatred. No external force has ever taken us down as a people. Even now, we're experiencing that in these days right now. Thank God, and we see miracles in front of us every single day.
Yeah.
Our external threats are being met with incredible bravery and courage. And the thing that I believe the number one threat facing us as a country and as a people are our internal threats, our internal divisions. And I think if we don't do some of the steps and some of the ideas that we spoke about here, that's a much bigger threat to us going forward as a nation than anything else.
I would just add that, and I thought I was going to be talking about, polarization, political polarization. And here I am giving a bunch of sermons. Tisha B'Av is the time of our greatest tragedy. It's sort of the model for all time of what Jewish tragedy is all about. But yet the Talmud tells us that the Messiah, Mashiach, was born on Tisha B'Av, right? And so the idea, again, is an extremely powerful idea that out of our greatest tragedy can come, our greatest salvation. But that doesn't just happen automatically. I don't have time to go into the whole story of in the Talmud there, but it's a very, very powerful idea. And I just want to say something. I know this is not necessarily an answer to any question that you asked, but let's just say that when I talk about Tisha B'Av being the deepest tragedy, like, you know, we're having fun and we're joking around and we're talking about Jewish unity, but let's not forget just how awful it is here. Right, meaning in so many ways, right? Most people probably don't know that 10 minutes before this webinar started, we were in our safe rooms because the siren went off because a Houthi missile. Where I sit right now in my house, right below the right at the bottom of the hill, I live at the top, lives Yariv Levin, who is the Minister of Justice of the State of Israel. When all the stuff with the judicial reform started, right? The big, demonstrations that were on television on CNN or Fox News were in Tel Aviv. But we had our own demonstrations going on here week after week with thousands and thousands of people. A few times I happened to be there for whatever reason. And I'm telling you, people call each other Nazis. People call each other traitors, Bulgar, right? People, it's literally hatred, right? So that's number one. And number two is where we sit, where JJ lives a few blocks away from me, right? I don't know, in our neighborhood, you'd probably know better, JJ, but at least, five or six soldiers were killed, since the beginning of the war, probably more. So things are really, really tough and very, very challenging. And so this is not just some cutesy discussion. This is something that we need to really figure out to the best that we can.
And use those things that are, if you will, the symptoms as a result of the war that are creating the disunity to prime the pump for creating it, for moving beyond it. And JJ, you also said correctly that we're experiencing tremendous miracles, and it's that disunity that's going to bring us down, not our enemies.
I'll just add, David very correctly listed all those real things that are happening, and he's being humble, but I won't be as humble. We both have children serving right now in the IDF. And I think they're some of the incredibly brave soldiers literally putting their lives on the line every single day to protect us all. And what are they protecting? They're protecting our ability to live here. And if we focus on these little silly things that are driving wedges between us and not focus on coming together and really advancing our society as one, then that's what they're fighting for. That's what they're out there for. To get rid of the evil that exists so that we can live in a very healthy, unified, just society.
The purpose. Now you're talking about the purpose of our being here, which has to be based on unity. And so to give purpose for that, that's excellent.
I just want to point out one thing, and that is that we're talking about attempts to solve this problem, and JJ's talking about his programs, which are great, and other organizations and other, institutions do other things. But the point of my article was to try a different approach, right? And the approach was one of what I called a business approach, right? What is the business plan for unity, right? Because I said we could do all these other things, but we can't seem to crack this. And this is perhaps our biggest challenge. So why don't we use approaches that are that work and succeed in other areas of our lives to try to solve this, right? So in America, I think that you don't need the government as much as you do in Israel, right?
In America, there's a lot of unity in America.
For now, for a whole bunch of different reasons, you know, the big foundations and, you know, and philanthropy is able to solve a lot of problems. The ethic of philanthropy is not as developed here in Israel, unfortunately, as it is in America. And most big things in Israel have not been accomplished without some kind of you know, government participation. So my humble suggestion is that we take this kind of approach where, whether it's business leaders, venture capital, I don't know, there has to be a way to apply these lessons that we've learned in other areas of life and apply it to this problem. It works way better. It should work way better than, you know, giving sermons and talk and, you know, saying over and over again, we have to be unified.
Yeah. Yeah. It needs substantial. And by the way, there's a lot of substantial ideas that are coming out of this, just this conversation amongst ourselves and not even from lots of input. The question is now putting pen to paper, getting the backing and making it happen. And there's a lot more. So I have a thought. I love your response. David, you've already run for Knesset. A couple years back, not that long ago, there was a wild card party that people voted for called the Pensioners Party. It was sort of like a protest vote. They got 7 seats from a bunch of, you know, I guess I shouldn't say old people because I'm on the verge of getting into that range, but a bunch of old people decided to come up with a party to advocate on behalf of pensioners, retirees. And that became the protest vote, and they got 7 seats, and they joined the government. I don't know how successful they were. I don't know what they stood for. But I was thinking, well, and whenever the next election will be, whether it's going to be in the first quarter or second quarter or last quarter of 2026, we're coming on an election here, and it's going to be divisive for a lot of reasons. What about creating the unity party? I think the name in Hebrew has already been used, so we would have to come up with a different name. But where that party is the conglomerate of all the kinds of people that you just mentioned, David, who are coming from all sectors of society, and they're going to sit in the Knesset and only focus on the prism of everything through unity. It sounds a little ridiculous, but
I think. There have been a lot of attempts to have a unity party or a middle ground party, not right, not left, but middle over the last few decades. And even right now, there are forums that exist to bring together different organizations to focus on strengthening the Merkaz or the middle. And there are attempts. There's an organization that's come up over the last couple of years called the Rivon HaRevi'i, translated, I think, to the fourth quarter, which is trying something similar from the ground up, building a whole groundswell of support to come up with policies that are being written together by people from all different sectors. And there are a lot of attempts. I would push back a little bit on what David said earlier, that all the big projects, successful projects, it's not disunity, it's disagreement. And I think it's a very important distinction. I wouldn't rely on the government. I think that's not a recipe for success, certainly not to start. I think to start, you have to start from the ground up. Once I think a lot of the big projects take off, then the government can join. Right. But I think it's got to stay.
I didn't say rely on the government. I said, if you think back to most successful big projects in Israeli society and in the history of the state of Israel, I don't think you could find many of that in way, shape, or form. Right.
Again, we can argue about the high tech sector and whether or not the Yozmav venture fund that was set up was what enabled it or not, or whether it was really an entrepreneurial spirit that was enabled to flourish here, grew the entire high tech sector, which I think is one of the biggest successes of, you know, the last few decades in Israeli society, as one example. But I think it needs to start from the ground up. I'll give you another example. Of not relying on the government. We were talking before the show a little bit. I went up north yesterday to Kiryat Shmona. And the north has been totally devastated over the last year and a half, with tens of thousands of residents evacuated. I was in Kiryat Shmona. pre the war, they had 25,000 residents. And even today, they're only about 60% back. Only about 15,000 of the residents have come back there. And what came up again and again and again from the residents themselves, unfortunately, is that they said that if there would be one or two or three Knesset members who lived in the north, then they would focus on the north. Our political system doesn't allow for, for representation by geography, as opposed to right. many other governments. And that's a problem. There's so many challenges that we have in this young state with our, with our political system and how we're elected. If it would be so good, great people like Rabbi David Fine would have been elected, but clearly it's not yet mature enough to enable those kinds of things to happen. So I would be hesitant to rely on the government. I think going back to another point that David said, by the way, about bringing business people into these efforts, I think is a great idea. And again, what David's doing, by the way, Berkai, is a business idea. They're training rabbis who are at the top of totem poles, who are then influencing others. It's focusing on influencers to then influence tens of thousands of others who they have influence over to be better Jews, better citizens of Israeli society, care for one another in communities. And similarly, in our organization, we just brought in a retired Air Force pilot who's not really retired because he's doing a lot of milouim and reserves. But he started, Daron Gavish, he started an initiative called the Stop Pilug. Pilug is division in English. And he, over a very short period of time, worked with municipalities across the country, together with Gesher now, and created online ideas of how to stop the division within Israeli society. And again, it's coming from, he's not a business person in this case, but he's definitely a leader. In Israeli society, we say that the biggest business leaders were the most senior people or generals or officers in the defense forces prior to their entering business. But that's a great idea.
On October 7th, 2023, Israel and the Jewish people suffered a massacre and calamity of unprecedented proportion, the largest number of Jews killed in one day since the Holocaust. That this is even something that we even measure is harrowing. Since then, the Jewish people have never felt more alone, in Israel and around the world. It brings us back to when 6 million of us were murdered in the Holocaust, and few rose to protect us. However, those who did, the righteous among the nations, can never be forgotten. They serve as a beacon of light for us today and for future generations. Footsteps was born in the wake of this most recent calamity to give you the opportunity to walk in the footsteps of the righteous among the nations, the righteous Gentiles. Footsteps is a boutique travel experience with a personal touch. You will experience stories of the righteous among the nations, their descendants, of the Jews they saved, and the generations that came from them. Through this, you'll be inspired to follow in their footsteps to inspire new generations of righteous among the nations, especially today when so much of the world is embracing overt anti-Semitism. In a generation where standing up for Israel and the Jewish people is no longer something to be taken for granted, stories of the righteous among the nations call out to us, inspire us, and are models for today and for our next generations. Please join us and get more information at genesis123.co.
I'll just say that I just want to correct something that I may have. Hold on, stop, full stop. I am not naive. I don't think that the government is going to solve everything or that we should rely on the government, right? What I'm saying is the government in many ways is part of the problem, right? What I'm saying is that in some ways, whether it's financial, whether there are other areas, and whether it's like you said, JJ, it could happen after it's already taken off. So I just want to make it clear that I'm not naive. I'm not naive because I was inside the system. And just so that everyone knows, when you say I ran for Knesset, like I have that on my bio, right? It makes it sound like, I was number 4 on the list or something, right? I mean, I was like number 9 billion on the list. Because I didn't do well enough in the primaries, but I've been on the inside, and it's very, very difficult. What you're suggesting, Jonathan, I would suggest is probably impossible to set up a party that would really compete in modern day Israel. By the way, one of the big problems in terms of polarization, political polarization is in Israel. And I suggested this when I was running for Knesset, but this would also be very difficult to achieve, is that the way Israeli politics work, right? Small parties, small far right, far left parties have a lot of control and are able to drag coalitions or prime ministers to this way or that way, as we've seen sometimes in the current war, right? Whereas in reality, most people are in the center, right? Most people agree about a lot of things, but we live in a system that doesn't accentuate that. We live in a system where we're pulled to the extreme. So I'll just say one last thing. There was a New York Times article last year that was talking about, I don't usually, you know, get my, let's just say I don't get my information from about Israel from the New York Times, but somebody happened to show me this article, and it said that, I think it was at Princeton University, it was one of the top universities, I forgot which one, it said that there were people, there were students.
A formerly top university.
There were students in the middle that wanted what they called a more nuanced approach, and they were having a very difficult time at Princeton. They were lonely. They couldn't find a group of people. Wow. Because the extremes have taken over, right? So I think that's true as well. You know, here, but politically speaking, I thought about starting a new party, and I've talked to many, many people very high in the political echelons in Israel and who know about doing these things. It is extremely extreme. It's probably easier to bring Jewish unity.
Right? No, I would take it down all the way by orders of magnitude down to a practical level. We have a lot of people listening here to our webinar. And thank you, Jonathan, for putting this together, especially now during the days before Tisha B'Av. I think it's critical. But I think if we can start something here today, the three of us and everyone listening and whoever's going to be watching this afterwards, go out after this webinar, go out for coffee with somebody who disagrees with you. If you live in Efrat and in the Judean Hills, go to Tel Aviv and take someone out for coffee and hear what they have to say and listen. And if you live in Tel Aviv, come to Jerusalem and go out with somebody who's on the other side of the spectrum, take a cup of coffee, and don't just leave it there. Take a picture of yourselves, put it up on social media, say what you learned about the other person, and maybe we should even create a hashtag of some sort. But I think it's something that from the grassroots, we can really make a difference if we start doing that. If everyone focuses on themselves and what they can do, we can really make a huge difference and build that. Now, this is going to sound like a plug, but build that guest share between all the different people within Israeli society. Build that.
I love it.
I just have two practical ideas as well. Something that I thought about while, JJ, you were speaking about this, what's it called? Stop Pilug? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a website, Stop Pilug.
I would say that I'm pretty involved and knowledgeable, I think most people would say, about what's going on in this area in Israel. And I never heard of that, right? And there are probably a lot of other things that you never heard of or I didn't hear of, right? I know that our friend Rabbi Shmuel Slutsky, who unfortunately, you know, lost two of his sons on October 7th, Yishai and Noam, Hashem Yikom Damam, right? He started something with relative, right?
Cousin, yeah.
Where they put an ad in newspapers every week, and I forget what it's called, where they Hadibur, the word. They call out politicians and news people who do not speak appropriately, right? How many people know about that, right? So if we could even gather, just as simple as that, gather all these different projects and make them more well-known so that more people can become involved, I think that would do wonders. I had another idea, but I forget.
Well, when you remember, I'm going to come back to you for one last round of kind of open thoughts, but I want to ask your help and anyone who's following here to not now to use the Q&A, but to email me any thoughts, because I'd like to take the notes from this conversation, boil it down, take links to, of course, what the two of you are doing and others and Hadibur, I also had never heard of, but I'm so impressed. And JJ, I love your idea about going to Tel Aviv. I had a very provocative conversation at a really loud wedding last spring with Ellie Stone, who I've mentioned. He's my neighbor. And we were talking about this. I don't remember how it came up, but it was far enough before Shavuot. It was before Passover that I said, why don't we make a thing where we, as Orthodox Jews, invite secular Jews to come to our homes for Shavuot. And instead of the traditional all night staying up studying Torah, we just have ice cream and cheesecake with secular Jews from Tel Aviv. and bring them into our world for conversations over something and call it, I like what I decided to call it, Na'aseh V'Nishma. Now, it needs somebody to do the Na'aseh part, to implement it. But I love the idea, JJ, you reminded me this through the simple act of just going to Tel Aviv, or for that matter, going to B'nai Barak.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, like David said, there are a lot of these types of initiatives. I mean, even on Tisha B'Av night, they have an initiative that's been going on for years called Halayla Lalomdim Torah, Tonight We're Not Learning Torah, where in cities across the country, people gather because you're not allowed to learn Torah except for specific parts of it. And they have discussions about issues of the day, and they bring in panels and speakers to bring people together. But it all goes back to that root cause, I think, that I started with. Is that once you meet somebody who you disagree with, it becomes very, very difficult to hate them. And I think if we focus on ways to meet them, you brought up the idea of coming for Shavuot. We've tried to do things like that, but then you run into the problem of you keep kosher, and then the secular person who doesn't keep kosher feels uncomfortable inviting you back to their home, or you feel uncomfortable eating in their home. So that becomes
the ice cream in their home.
A technical issue. So that's why I suggested coffee. But yeah, there are a lot of these great initiatives, and we should all embrace them and do them, and not just do them ourselves, but also talk about them in on social media or wherever people.
Good. I like that very much. I like how social media started in this conversation as being something that's a problem, but a couple of times we brought it back to use. We're not going to shut down social media, but we have to use it properly. I will say
that the first thing I'm going to do after this is over is I'm going to get together with JJ and have a cup of coffee. We'll take a picture. And I want to say something just to push back a little of what you said about your Shavuot idea. Actually, I disagreed that the learning of Torah should be left out, meaning the learning of Torah properly, right, is the most unifying thing that a Jew should be able to do together. The problem is in Israel, because of all the problems between the religious and the non-religious, is that the non-religious think that it's not theirs, right? And it's just as much theirs as it is mine, right? Mm-hmm. We just have to learn how to talk about it and how to interact about it. But you talk about, and this is the last thing I'll say, you talked about shutting down social media. So I want to talk about a project that I have that's in its infancy. And I hope will happen, but it may not, because it involves a lot of different organizations. And unfortunately, when you involve a lot of organizations, it involves a lot of politics. But I am working with Orthodox rabbinic organizations around the world so that we can ask people, call from the pulpit and in articles and other communications, call from the pulpit that from during the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, during the 10 days of repentance from the first day of Rosh Hashanah till after Yom Kippur, that people go off social media.
Wow.
Okay. Okay. Now, obviously, if you need to advertise a Torah lecture that you're having, or somebody needs help or whatever, that could be an exception. But all talk about politics, issues, right, that we are going to say that the Aseret Yemei Tshuva is to be without those kinds of things. And I believe that could make a small dent in some of this problem. So look for further information as the high holidays get closer.
Please share it. I like that, and I'll share it widely. Let's wrap it up.
So let me just conclude. This will be my final piece. You've taken us around the Jewish calendar, I feel like, from Tisha B'Av to Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur to Passover, Shavuot. I feel like it's a medley of some Jewish Hasidic singers. But I want to focus on actually the last 3 weeks. My son just came back yesterday from a summer camp in Israel. This goes along the lines of what David was just saying. And at Gesher, we also run a summer camp along the model of the American summer camps, where kids get together, religious and secular, for 11 days. And for Israelis to think of sending their kids away for 11 days is almost unheard of. And we say there that the religious and secular are living there together. They're not just talking about Jewish unity. Right. They're living Jewish unity.
Right.
And what makes that happen, part of what makes that happen, is exactly what David just said. It's 11 days, or my son was for 3 weeks, without phones. They don't have phones. Mm-hmm. They don't have smartphones. They put them away. They give it to them for a half hour at the end of the day to call their parents or for whatever the case may be. But they're living life. They're stepping out of their keyboards, and they're living life, experiencing life. And they have to figure things out with one another. And I think if we can all figure out in our own lives, somehow that we can do something similar, how we can really experience life with somebody who's different than we are, that can really, again, I think that can go a long way to what everything we're talking about here.
I like
and
it.
Jonathan, thank you for the opportunity and inviting us here tonight. And David,
yeah, guys, I really didn't know where
Jonathan.
I didn't really know where the conversation was going to go. Initially, I had a very different, completely different direction. And no, I kind of hope maybe we would resolve all the issues, but I'm brought back to the age old question. Although usually people who are not kosher refer to elephants, I will use a giraffe. How do you eat a giraffe? It's one bite at a time. And so I think that's what we've come to the conclusion. Lots of different bites and opportunities that we can and must. So I would invite everybody who's listening now live, and we'll get the link to this, and anyone who's listening not live and gets the link. We happen to be talking at the end of July in the summer of 2025, but this is relevant and will be relevant for the foreseeable future. And I will gather, I'll do my best with your help, JJ and David, to kind of gather resources. And I'm a good provocateur. So let me help to provoke people. I do like to end my programs with giving the last word, even though you just said you both, it was going to be your last word. Since I do this, I don't want to miss the opportunity. We've talked about a lot of stuff. We're not coming up with a silver bullet for it all specifically, but what have we not addressed? What has been provoked today that maybe you hadn't thought about that you want to share, or any final closing remarks that you guys would like to make? David, we started with you.
I don't want to sound arrogant, although I guess I will, that I've been thinking about these issues for decades. I don't think that we spoke about anything, big gadol, in general that I haven't necessarily thought about before. But I think the most important thing that I learned, that I heard from JJ in terms of my active listening, is what he said about looking at a person as a person and not as a label. And I think we all do that, right? In our community, in Modi'in, around Shabbat tables, unfortunately, sometimes people are spoken about as a label in all parts of Israeli society, instead of being thought of as and looked at as a person. And so every person has a neshama, every person has a Jewish soul, and we were all part of, that giving of the Torah, all souls according to Jewish tradition were there. So if we were there and we were unified then, right, then we could be unified now. It
Great.
Takes effort. It takes human effort, but it's something that is achievable if we are able to just put our minds to it.
Excellent. JJ?
I'll just end with briefly, that the Mishnah says, the Talmud says that, or the Mishnah says that, Ehov et HaBriyot u'mekarvan la'Torah. We should love other humans, and we should try to bring them closer to Torah. And that's what we're basically charged to do. And I think we all, as a Jewish people, have a lot to focus on still on the first two words of Ehov et HaBriyot, and really just love our fellow neighbors and other Jewish people. And hopefully through that, we'll also be able maybe to mekarvan l'Torah. But I think even if we just focus on those first two words of loving our fellow Jews, we will go a long way. And it brings me back, really, I have nothing really other things smart to say other than the Gesher tagline, which is be different, be together.
Nice. Thank you. Rabbi David Fine, J.J. Sussman, thanks for taking time and for the really great comments and insight today. We will be sharing this, God willing, widely, and a year from now, at least be able to hopefully look back and say that there's been a positive move in whatever. Thank you for joining tonight.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, JJ.
As we always wrap up the Inspiration from Zion webinars and podcasts, we have a great program called From Jonathan's Bookshelf. It's to encourage you to like, comment, and share the link to this program. You're not seeing my bookshelf, and about 2 years ago, I dispensed giving away copies of other people's books because we published at the Genesis 123 Foundation our remarkable book called Israel the Miracle. For Jewish people following, I want to encourage you to get the book. It's a compilation of essays as a coffee table book, stunning presentation by 75
Christian leaders all around the world writing about why Israel is so significant. For us, for the Jewish people, to see those words coming from Christians is really, really inspiring. And if you are a Christian, then you need to get multiple copies, because this is something that when you're no longer around, your children and grandchildren are going to want to fight over. Well, no disunity, but everyone's going to want their copy, so get many. And all we ask that you do is like, copy, or share a link to this program, and I pick one person at random each month to get their own copy for free. We're always grateful that the podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also special thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. And if you'd like to sponsor an episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd always love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue, and specifically invite you to send any questions as well about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and all your loved ones are safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah.